You're listening to the Make It British podcast. I'm Kate Hills and I'm on a one-woman mission to save UK manufacturing. In 2008, I gave up my 20-year career as a fashion buyer because I was disillusioned with how much was being sourced overseas, and I set out to uncover some of the amazing businesses that are still making in the UK. Since founding Make It British, I've discovered that there is not only still tons of manufacturing taking place in Britain, but that it's a thriving industry. I invite you to join me each week when I'll be chatting to inspiring British-made brands and UK manufacturers and offering advice to product-based businesses that make in the UK. So with no further ado, let's get on with the show. Hello and welcome to episode number 291 of the Make It British podcast. So today I'm going to play you a recording of a webinar I did this week called Micro Factories and Supply on Demand, UK Manufacturing at its Best. And it's such great content. I thought it was really worth sharing here today on the podcast. So this is the audio version of the webinar. If you want to see the full video presentation with my slides, go to makeitbritish.co.uk/microfactories, and I'll put the link in the show notes for the podcast and you can watch the video version there. But here you go. Here is Micro Factories and Supply on Demand. Everything you need to know about making in the UK and busting some of those myths that people have about manufacturing here in Britain. Thank you so much for coming to my webinar this morning. Let's get cracking because we've got quite a lot to get through. So let me switch straight to my slides. Right, okay. Thank you for coming. So this is my little celebration today of 15 years since I registered the domain makeitbritish.co.uk. Okay, not to be confused with when I wrote the first blog post for Make It British, which was actually 2 years later, 2011, and then registered the business in 2013. But it's 15 years since I first had the idea to do Make It British. So I'm going to give you a little bit of a run through about the current UK manufacturing landscape, the benefits of manufacturing locally in the UK, hopefully to inspire you if you're not already manufacturing in the UK, why you should think about doing that. And I'm also going to tell you a little bit about how I got here in the first place and why I am such a firm believer in local manufacturing. Okay, for those that don't know me and why I'm here, I am the founder of Make It British, a platform for supporting businesses that manufacture in the UK. I am passionate about UK manufacturing and helping brands to find the value in making locally. Now, this is me back in 1992. So I studied fashion at Middlesex Poly. And when I graduated, I launched my own brand. It was one of the first, if not, I think it was the very first recycled clothing brand back in 1992. It was before the days of the internet. So this is the only picture I've got. It's a dodgy looking picture from when we were in the featured in The Guardian. That is a massive pile of old curtains and blankets in the back of me there. And we manufactured everything ourselves with a few machinists that we had in our own micro factory in our warehouse in East London. So everything was made in-house in small quantities and cut by hand, as you can see there. So at the time, sustainable fashion, or eco and green fashion, as it was called back then, was something very new. So we got a lot of press coverage. I mean, look at that quote. If you're not interested in recycling in this day and age, then you're not in tune with the 90s. I mean, it's actually impossible to believe that we're 30 years on from that, more than 30 years on. And only now is recycling and circular fashion finally having a good foothold in the UK. Also got a lot of press. That's Kate Moss wearing my jacket in Vogue. One of the issues as a recycled brand that we had back then was there was always only ever one of everything we made. Everything was pretty much made to order. So, of course, everyone wanted Kate's jacket and we only ever had one of those that we could actually sell. That was a feature we got. First ever piece of press that we got there back in the Face magazine that really kicked everything off. I'm telling you this story basically so that you know this is what I did and this is how I first started out and why I think it's so important and why I really champion micro factories that are here in the UK. The brand that I had lasted about 3 years. Unfortunately, we ended up losing a lot of money because a wholesale agent we were using at the time did the dirty on us, left us with loads of unpaid bills. So at that point, I then went and sold my soul to the high street. Right. Who's old enough to remember Tammy Girl? Because that's where I ended up after having my own brand and my own micro factory for 3 years. I ended up as a designer working for a high street children's wear brand called Tammy Girl. I think the logo on the right that you see is the one from the mid-90s. The other one that you can see in the big picture is from the 80s. But when I worked at Tammy Girl as the designer, I also was responsible for cutting the patterns, doing the costings and going to the factories, because all the factories that we used at Tammy Girl, bar maybe a couple that we had making jeans for us in Turkey, all the rest were based in the UK. We had school uniform made in Hackney. We had knitwear made in Manchester. We had T-shirts made in Leicester. So if ever there was a problem with any of the patterns that I'd cut as a designer, I was able to go to the factory and go and fix the problem. It was really simple. I would literally get the bus up to Hackney. Tammy Girl didn't pay us enough money for us to afford to get taxis. So I would be on the bus in the factory fixing the patterns, because you could do that. Then after I left Tammy, I went to Burberry. Again, who remembers Burberry when it had an S on the end and that was its logo and it was called Burberry's? So as well as it having a different spelled name and logo, when I worked there, and that's the building I worked in a picture at the top, I worked in a building in Hackney in East London. And within that building, you not only had all the kind of head office and the board team, you had all the designers and the buyers, but you also had the factory. So there was a factory on site in London at Burberry's headquarters, also making most of their clothing. So they had the factory in Hackney, but then they also had factories in Wales, in Yorkshire, all over the UK. And then what happened while I was at Burberry, that was at the point, that was mid-90s, when they started closing the factories down. So you can see from this picture in the bottom there, keep Burberry British. There were protests when Burberry shut their factories. That's one from a factory they had in Wales. So that was a turning point when brands like Burberry started to move their production offshore. At that point, some of the factories they started using were in places like Hong Kong. And of course, loads of people lost their jobs that were working for those factories in Burberry. So then I went to work for Marks and Spencer's. Actually, there was a brief stint I had between Burberry and Marks and Spencer's. I actually worked for a short time in Italy for a company that made accessories for Levi's. And I learned from that, from working in Italy as well, the value that the Italians have about craftsmanship and making locally. And then I came back, and at that point, I started specializing in accessories, and I went to work for Marks and Spencer's on their handbag department, first as a designer, and then I switched over to be a buyer on the handbag department. And I did that for 10 years. And in those 10 years, while I worked for Marks and Spencer's, they went from, again, like Burberry, they had lots of factories that were making for them locally all over the UK, massive factories making for them, to starting to move everything offshore. And my final couple of years at Marks and Spencer's, I actually worked on the accessories department. And one of the areas that I bought was scarves. And I remember sitting in a meeting with the Yorkshire textile mill, Abraham Moon, who are still going. But I remember sitting in a meeting with them to say that we weren't going to be buying their scarves from them anymore, that their scarves that were made in Yorkshire, because we were going to source them from a factory that we'd found overseas in China. We also didn't give them much notice. It was literally massive amounts of business that M&S was giving them. Till the next season, all that business was pulled and we started sourcing from China. And it's never sat comfortably with me. I still remember the look on the poor guy's face when we told him this tragic news that Marks and Spencer's were taking their orders overseas. So, I mean, who here can remember the St. Michael brand as well? And that was also the time when Marks and Spencer's lost their St. Michael brand, which was their sub-brand that they used to use on all their clothing. And as you can see from that label there, made in the UK. Made in the UK was a popular term that Marks and Spencer's often used to put on all of their products. So after spending a decade at Marks & Spencer's, I then went to Debenhams. Now, I'm sure the Blue Cross, those massive Blue Cross banners with 70% off were splattered over the Debenhams windows, probably 30, 40% of the year. And the problem with Debenhams is they had to buy everything in such high margins. So they were making stuff so cheaply in order to be able to put it in those Blue Cross sales. So it was a real, totally different to the way I was working at Marks & Spencer's. Suddenly I landed in this buying job at Debenhams where the goal that we were given as buyers was to buy everything in as cheaply as possible. The picture you see at the bottom is the lovely Melissa Rodebrash, who's a swimwear designer, and one of my departments at Debenhams was swimwear. That swimsuit that you can see there was one of my best sellers. The special thing about that swimsuit was that it was made in Portugal. Everything else in the Debenhams swimwear department was made in China. We had one small collection that we did with Melissa Rodebrash that was made reasonably locally in Portugal. It always fitted really well. It sold really well because the fit was great. But because the margins were not as good on those products we were getting from Portugal compared to China, because, and I'll explain a little bit more about margins as we go through, but because the initial margin that the director saw that I was buying these swimsuits that maybe were only making us maybe only a 70% margin rather than 80% margin that we were getting from China, I had to tell them that we would no longer be buying from them either in Portugal. So we had to drop the Portuguese supplier we had. And yet again, I was in that situation where I built up partnerships with suppliers, with manufacturers, and then the money men, and it was mostly men, I'm afraid to say, who were at the top, turned around and said, you can't work with these people anymore. You need to get it in as cheaply as possible. So I packed in without even thinking what I was doing. I literally thought, I've had enough of this. Once the Portuguese supplier had the situation where I had to tell the Portuguese supplier I weren't going to work with them anymore, I thought there must be, this is really short-sighted. We've only been making overseas for the last 10 or 20 years. We used to have a thriving textile industry in the UK. And now, very short-sightedly, we're ditching all of that and going overseas. And what's going to happen when we want to bring it back? So in 2009, packed in my job at Debenhams, I registered the domain makeitbritish.co.uk. And I had the idea that I was going to set up an online Amazon-style marketplace for British-made goods. So I set about researching this big business idea. That's why I set up the domain back then in 2009, because I had this idea that people were going to start making things locally again. It took me a couple of years to finally start doing anything with that domain. So in March 2011, 13 years ago, I then wrote the first blog post for Make It British, which was entitled, Is Nothing Made in Britain Anymore? I ditched the idea of setting up the marketplace because I realized I didn't have a bottomless budget to be able to afford to do marketing to get the traffic I needed to that marketplace and build that sort of website back then. But I knew I wanted to support local manufacturing and made in Britain. So I wrote this blog post, Is Nothing Made in Britain Anymore? And I set out to uncover all of the amazing brands and manufacturers that we still have left in the UK. And not only that, but I also found that not only were there a lot of the businesses still left, but there was new ones opening up. And in the last 13 years, I've seen a real difference and a real change in the perception of UK manufacturing and in the amount of businesses that are making here. So what I'm going to do now, I am going to bust some of the myths surrounding UK manufacturing for you. Right. So myth number one is that we've lost most of the UK's fashion and textile supply chain. And I am mostly focusing on fashion and textiles here. Although I cover other areas, I'm really, in the last couple of years, I've really honed down on supporting the UK's fashion and textile supply chain because that is where my background is. And that is where the Industrial Revolution started with textiles in the UK. So myth number one is that we've lost most of the UK's fashion and textile supply chain. Well, we actually haven't. There's still quite a lot remaining, okay? A great example of that is John Smedley. It is the oldest textile mill in the UK, if not, I think, the world. Okay. And it's still in existence. It's thriving. They've got, it's like they're gradually, adapting the business. So it runs on green energy. And it's a thriving business. So we've got the oldest textile mill still here in the UK in Derbyshire. We've also got the last remaining lace maker in Nottingham, Clooney Lace, who some of you may have seen on my Instagram recently, originally with the UK textile industry. Different areas gradually started being known for different types of textiles and manufacturing. So, for instance, Yorkshire for woolen fabric, the Derbyshire area for knitwear, Scotland for cashmere, Northamptonshire for footwear. Nottingham and Nottinghamshire was known for lace. And there used to once be hundreds of lace makers in Nottingham. They've even got an area in the city centre that's the lace market, which is where all the lace traders used to go. Clooney Lace is a ninth generation, I think it is, family business, still making lace in Nottingham. I went to see it a couple of weeks ago. It's absolutely fascinating. It's amazing. And they're weaving it still on the original machines from over 100 years ago in the way that they would have made it back in Victorian times. It's absolutely incredible. And they sell it to designers the world over. But as well as the heritage businesses and the heritage manufacturers we've got, we've also got plenty of amazing new things that are opening up and like first ofs again. For instance, Courtney & Co, button makers in Gloucestershire, they started making natural shell buttons again. The guy that set it up, David Courtney, actually read, I think, in a newspaper article or something that the last remaining shell button maker in the UK was closing down. He was so kind of moved by the story that he actually decided to invest his own money to set up button making again, and natural button making in the UK. And again, that's a thriving business as well. I'm actually going to visit them on Friday, which is really exciting. When it comes to recycling as well, I told you like my first business was a recycled clothing company. We've now got a lot of recycling going on in the UK. The award for the most difficult business name to pronounce has to be Inuinu. I can't even say it, but it's certainly a name that everyone remembers. It actually stands for it, if it is not over until it is over, or something like that. The guy that you can see here is the amazing Dr. John Parkinson, who has set up this textile recycling business in Yorkshire to reprocess waste woolen cashmere into new yarns. And little known fact, I actually once used to buy fabric from John Parkinson, Dr. John Parkinson, back in the 90s, back when I had my recycled clothing business. We also used to use some of his organic fabric back in the 90s. So it's great to see that he's back in the textile industry again. We've also got businesses like Black Horse Lane Atelier, who make jeans in London. They have received a grant recently for a denim research and development wash facility. It is the first eco denim washing facility, and they're based in London. We've also got the lovely guys at Shartex, who have invested their own money in seamless knitting machines, which are the first of their kind in the UK. They make seamless garments and athleisure wear in their factory in Leicester. What's really interesting about Shartex is that it's family business. So you can see the dad in the middle, Tejas, who's the son who's taken over second from the left. It's a family business. And they had, over the last few years, up until they bought these machines, gradually they were supplying companies like Boohoo, fast fashion, and gradually the quality of what they were making, they were just saying, we don't want to be in this low value, high volume fabric business anymore. It's just a race to the bottom. It's just all about price. We're going to do something different and something more high end, and we're going to set that up ourselves. And yeah, hats off to them. Amazing that we've got people that are doing something like that now here in the UK. Also got businesses like Contrado, who do make on demand in North London. It's really interesting about their business. And what you might notice that is different about this picture of this factory here in the Contrado factory, it's digital. So what Contrado have done to enable them to supply on demand, because what they do, you can literally go on the Contrado website, you can design your own product, upload your own print, choose which product you want to put it on, and they will print, make and deliver it within a matter of days. If not, I think it's something like 48 hours, if not less, turnaround time. And the reason they're able to do that is because the whole business is digitized. So from the minute you place your order, to the minute the order goes out the door, everything is tracked by computers. But that also means that they know exactly how long it takes to make every single item, which means they can really accurately cost it. But it also means they can make lots of different products in their factory because they've got different machinists doing different things. So the variety of what they make is amazing. It's well worth going to have a visit if you possibly can and seeing what they do. Another factory I've been to recently is the David Nipa factory in Alfreton, Derbyshire. They are a fully vertical manufacturing company now, probably one of those manufacturers that you haven't even heard of. Christopher Nipa is the current MD of David Nipa. It was set up by his dad, David, and it's a catalogue business selling clothing for women of a certain age, shall we say. They make everything in the UK. They started with just the sewing. Then they introduced knitting and linking. So then they introduced printing their own catalogues. They were, you know, realising they were getting delays waiting for catalogues to be printed. So they bought the catalogue business and they print their own catalogues. Then they decided they wanted to get into digital printing because a lot of the clothing that they sell is printed and they didn't want to have to wait for other printers and for delays for fabric coming from Europe. So Christopher had the vision to set up a digital printing plant. Then he realised he also needed to be able to do dyeing and finishing. So I've got a little video here. I mean, probably a lot of you have seen it on my Instagram, but let me just play it for you here, where you can see everything that they do. I mean, this is a short, really, really short snapshot to just show that they're totally vertical. They're doing everything in one place. And what is amazing about that is that they are pretty much making on demand for their customers. The order comes in, they can send out their catalogues, they can get the orders in. The customers, they wait slightly longer than Contrado. They might wait for kind of around a week or two, but they're not waiting for any suppliers. The only thing that they're not doing on site yet is actually knitting or weaving their own fabric. But everything else they're doing here, and they do everything for themselves in the David Nipa factory. So they have total control of their own production. And as a result, it means that they sell everything they make. So they don't discount things. So they sell everything at full price. And that is really important when it comes to making in the UK. And I'm going to talk to you a little bit in a minute about why that's the case. Okay, so myth number two is that there are very few garment manufacturers in the UK. Now, I know I've kind of put the answer to this on my Instagram this week. So if anyone, I did a talk for the Textile Institute last week in person. And so many people said, I can't come down to London, I can't get to see it. So this is why I'm doing it online today. And I asked the question last week, how many garment manufacturers do you think we have here in the UK? I'm going to ask you all to pop it in the chat, but there's probably someone here that's already seen the answer on my Instagram. What someone did say last week, someone in the audience who actually, I hate to say it, used to work with me at M&S, actually said there's only 25, which I was like, oh, you should know. I mean, anyway, it's in four figures, I can tell you. Now, this is an approximate figure. According to the UK Fashion and Textile Association, from research they did a couple of years ago, there were 4,005 garment manufacturers across Britain, and that was a 13% increase since we left the EU. Now, you may be thinking, well, where the hell are they yet then? Now, with that figure, and I actually think it probably may be higher, a lot of those businesses are micro businesses. 90% of UK fashion and textile manufacturers employ less than 10 people. So unlike the factory in the previous slide, which is actually Jenny Holloway's Fashion Enter factory in North London, which makes over 15,000 garments a week for big multiple retailers like ASOS and Tesco and M Brown, the majority of UK garment fashion and textile manufacturers employ less than 10 people. And many of those are actually businesses that make their own, micro factories like the one I had back in the 90s, who make their own products in-house. So that's why there's not a 4,000 that you all know about that are all well-known, because they're all tiny and a lot of them make for their own brand predominantly. So let me give you some examples of some of those brand-owned micro factories. Hyatt Denim in Wales. They are owned and operated by the brand themselves, Hyatt Denim. I don't think they currently make for anyone else. And what's interesting about Hyatt, actually they're set up in Cardigan in Wales, which was once a town that was predominantly making for jeans for Marks and Spencers. It wasn't owned by M&S. M&S never, unlike Burberry, M&S never owned any of its own factories. But the workers in that town worked for a factory that made for Marks and Spencers. And David Hyatt, that set it up, wanted to start making jeans again in the town. So he's employed some of the people that originally used to make for Marks and Spencers, they call the grandmasters, who've then trained up a team of other local people to make their jeans. They make everything in-house, all their jeans in-house. They started just doing jeans. I think they maybe do have a couple of shorts in the range now, but they still predominantly just make jeans. Then you've got people like Emma Willis, who is a shirt maker on Savile Row. She used to make with other factories when she first started out her business. Then she decided she wanted to be master of her own destiny. So she set up a factory in Gloucestershire, making all the Emma Willis shirts. And she has her own training school there. She's got a lot of young people working for her. And she came to the talk last week at the Textile Institute, which was brilliant, and said that she doesn't have any problem getting people to go and work in her factory to train them up. She said it only takes them a matter of weeks to train up people to the level that they need. And bear in mind, these are high-end Savile Row shirts. They've got a method now, a training school. Just really works. One thing you'll notice with both Hyatt and Emma Willis is they're only making one type of product. So they're not trying to do everything. They are specialists in one thing. And that is one of the reasons why I think it really works. Then you've got Something Wicked, who make lingerie up in Leeds. And again, I'm telling you, I could show you probably hundreds of these micro businesses, but we haven't got enough time today. So I'm giving you a variety of different micro factories in different areas making different types of fashion and textile products. So we've also got Something Wicked, and they make lingerie up in Leeds. And Leeds was once an area that was known for making garments. And they're in a building, an original building, which was also an original textile building back in Leeds. Also, we've got brands making their own knitwear in-house as well. We've got the lovely Kate here from Ubas Knitwear up in the Lake District in Cumbria, who's got a couple of her own machines and people working for her making knitwear. Setting up a knitting factory is more expensive, obviously, than setting up something like a garment factory. She's actually had funding to help her set that up as well. So she's got knitting machines, linkers, washing, drying facilities, all up there in Cumbria. Amazing. So let's move on now to myth number three, is that no one cares where their clothes are actually made. So in other words, you might be thinking, well, I don't know why I bother making in the UK, or I don't know why I would bother making in the UK, because no one really cares. The customers don't care where it's made. Well, actually, I would say that's wrong. Judging by the amount of traction that the Fashion Revolution Who Made My Clothes campaign has received since it's been running over the last 10 years, people really do care. More and more brands are being asked to be transparent about not only where their products are being made, but by whom. Okay, so long gone are the days where no one really cares. This is really coming to the forefront now, obviously aided by social media, where anyone can start to find out or ask questions. The campaign is now huge. The next Fashion Revolution, it started as a Fashion Revolution Day. It's now Fashion Revolution Week. It takes place in April, and everyone uses the hashtag Who Made My Clothes. And that's a really great one for brands that are making in the UK, factories that are making in the UK, to get behind and really show who it is that's making their products. This is probably one of my favourite slides. This is Google searches for the term made in UK since 2009. So 2009, when I first had the idea that people would want to start making in the UK again, look at the increase in the amount of searches that we've had. So that graph, it's not the number of searches, it's the kind of, it's relative. So as you can see, probably between 2009 and today, there's about four times more searches. The two peaks that you can see on that graph are both of the lockdowns. I think part of that, judging by the amount of traffic as well that I had to my website in those times, it was people looking for PPE made in the UK a lot in those during those times. But also because people were indoors shopping more, looking for things that were made locally. But look at the increase that we've had over the last few years with people that are interested in finding products that are made in the UK. So just a few stats from you. There's been various research done over the years in terms of what interest there is in making in the UK. There's not been anything done in the last couple of years, unfortunately. Probably the most notable one was the Barclays one that was done in 2018, which was they surveyed 8,000 consumers across 8 international markets to find out what the average price differential was that people were willing to pay for UK-made products. And the research found that the demand for UK-made goods had grown by 36%. So that kind of ties in with what you saw on that graph. It also found that consumers consider provenance an important factor and an important influence on their decisions to purchase products, and that UK goods in particular are perceived as high quality, reliable, internationally respected and good value for money. And further research here, this one was Statista, 2017, this one was before, I think this one was probably not long after the EU referendum. So this was to find out what made in label do people most value. And as you can see, the UK came in fourth after the EU, though I don't think you often get a product with a made in EU label on it. But after just Germany and Switzerland, the UK came in next as being one of the country that was most highly ranked for a label that says made in UK. Right. So now I've shown you the value of a UK label. Let's now look at myth number 4, that making in the UK is more expensive. Now, yes, the cost of labour in the UK is more than in a lot of other countries. But I also want you to challenge what you define as expensive and why you're not comparing eggs with eggs when you're looking at the cost of UK manufacturing versus the cost of manufacturing overseas. And it all comes down to, and I'm not going to get too technical and mathsy here, but in terms of your intake margin versus your exit margin. So what is your real profit that you make on a product when you make it in the UK, you make it locally, you make it to order, you make it in small quantities, and you don't put loads of discounts and markdowns on it. So in other words, when you can see on this graph, the red part on comparing these two charts, the red is the cost of making the product. And on here, I've compared the cost like for like with making a t-shirt overseas compared to making it in the UK. The red part is the cost. Yes, the cost is more, but you don't have the shipping, the duty. And what you also don't have if you make in the UK, if you're buying in small quantities and you're not putting loads of products in the sale, which you are probably, because if you're making loads of products overseas, yes, your cost price might be lower. But if you're sell through, in other words, like Christopher Nieper does, if the amount of product that you sell at full price is really high, then you're going to have much less of your product is going to be subject to markdowns or even like disposal or wastage or unsold stock. Okay, so you just buy what you sell. So what we're talking about with exit margin is the true value of how much profit you make. Because a business like Debenhams, and that's what I really noticed when I worked at Debenhams, particularly as I was on swimwear, which is a seasonal department, was that although our intake margin was really high, it was in like the 80s to the mid 80s, the percentage of product that was discounted, like 80% of the Debenhams stock was sold in those blue cloth cross days, okay, at massive discounts, like up to 70%. So they never actually made that 86% profit margin, considerably less. Plus it was swimwear, so it was seasonal. So we always got to the end of the season, there was loads of unsold stock. And where did that go? Definitely went in landfill. It was really difficult to sell bikinis when you've got half different tops and bottoms and none of them match. So got to get rid of all of that. So the true value of how much they actually sold, which was why when I had that swimwear supplier in Portugal, who made me product that had a really good sell through because it was beautifully designed. It was made, it fitted really well, and it was made locally. It actually was more profitable because these big businesses don't have ways of working out. It's so complicated for them to work out their exit margin compared to their intake margin that they don't even take into account the costs of all the buying trips flying all over the world, the sampling costs backwards and forwards, trying to get fit to work. So for smaller businesses making locally, it makes much more sense to actually be making here and making in small quantities. Okay. So in summary there, we may not be the cheapest in the UK, but we are the best. The UK is never going to be the place for high volume, low value garment manufacturing. For a start, we don't have the big factories to cope with the high volume, and that's not what we should be aiming for anyway. Reshoring back from places like China is probably not realistic for a lot of the really big high street stores anyway. And also for some product types, like some manufacturing we have lost here. Like there's very, very few manufacturers other than Gina, for instance, that will make women's high heel shoes in any volume. So whilst there is a high demand for making in the UK, the opportunity most definitely lies in micro factories. Okay. The factories that are making all the ones I've shown you so far that are making high quality in low volume. So let me give you a few more examples of those. I mentioned Black Horse Lane, actually, but all of the UK jeans makers, the average pair of a UK made jeans is probably 150 to 250. I think some of Black Horse Lane's jeans are 280 plus. But they have a dedicated community of fans who are willing to pay that much because they know those jeans will last. They know they will last because they offer a lifetime repair on them. So you can send them back for repair. They don't make stuff that's disposable and throwaway. So the cost per wear of those jeans, if you can keep them for 20 or 30 years because you keep getting them repaired, is so much better than a pair that you might only buy for 20 or 30 pounds that the denim on them is really bad quality. The seams aren't really strong. You chuck them away and buy another pair. Okay, they're just timeless. The same as someone like Johnson's of Elgin, cashmere manufacturers up in Scotland. They do knitted cashmere, woven cashmere. They used to make woven cashmere scarves for me when I was at Burberry. In fact, they still make the cashmere scarves for Burberry as well, which is amazing. And they have survived not because they ever tried to then be the cheapest, but because they were the best. And we are known the world over for the cashmere that we make in Scotland because it's the very best quality. Same with shoes made in Northamptonshire. Joseph Cheney is a great example. They make all of their shoes, both the uppers and the lasting, all done in Northamptonshire. So 100%, unlike some of the shoemakers in Northamptonshire, get the uppers stitched in India and then ship them over here. Barkers, not mentioning them. Anyway, so someone like Cheney's, Trickers, again, they repair the shoes. So you can buy the shoes and you can get the soles repaired and fixed again. And again, they last a very, very long time. So I could give you so many more examples of these amazing businesses. But one of the things you'll notice that they've got in common is that it's a quality product that's made to last. Okay, so finally, myth number 5 is that making in the UK is unethical. Now, what do I mean by that? Now, we've all seen the headlines in the news about sweatshops in Leicester paying workers less than £3.50 an hour. For every factory that is willing to cut corners and underpay workers, there are so many that do believe in paying a fair wage and doing the right thing. But the good factories need to be paid a fair price in order to be able to pay their workers fairly. So it's every brand's responsibility to ensure that they know how long a product or a garment takes to make, so they don't expect unethical cost prices from factories, nor ask them to cut corners or turn a blind eye, okay? Brands must ensure purchasing practices that allow suppliers to pay their workers fairly. And it is a kind of really complicated situation up in Leicester. Unfortunately, now that Boohoo have had all this back press, what have they done? They've not fixed it. They've jumped ship and left. And that's, you know, I'm not going to go into the situation in Leicester because there's some amazing things going on in Leicester. I'm actually in Parliament next week with a really great organisation called Labour Behind the Label, who were doing so much to highlight the plight of Leicester garment workers since Boohoo pulled out of Leicester. And it's just driven some workers into poverty. And it's been because businesses like Boohoo are expecting them to make products at unrealistic prices. Another example of a great manufacturer doing ethical things in the UK is Jenny Holloway's Fashion Enter factory in North London. I think she just won the Draper's Sustainable Business Award recently, which is amazing. Now, one of the things that Jenny does at her factory, which is really interesting, is she uses a software system called Galaxius. So every single worker in the factory has a mobile phone with this piece of software on. And it means, a bit like the Contrado factory, means that she can track every garment going through the factory and know exactly how long every garment takes to make, okay? Which means that she can afford to pay performance-related pay because she knows how long it takes people to make things. Everyone earns above the London living wage, and many of her staff actually earn 50% over that because they're so quick at what they do. So being able to use and integrate technology into garment factories really allows them to charge the right prices and make sure they're having the most efficient factories while passing on that value to the customers as well. So done right, making in the UK is one of the most sustainable ways to produce clothing. And that actually was reiterated by some research that Christopher Nieper of David Nieper did a couple of years ago. He did a study with the University of Nottingham that found that 40% less carbon emissions are created by manufacturing clothes in the UK in comparison to a similar operation in an overseas factory. So for instance, I think he said something like they compared China, Bangladesh, Turkey and the UK. And one of the reasons that the UK produces less carbon emissions, not only because of there's less transporting the product around, but actually we have a lower carbon intensity in our electric supply network as well. So compared to the UK, China typically releases 90% more greenhouse gas emissions than making the same product in the UK, Turkey 70% more and Bangladesh 24% more. So if anyone's interested in that research, I've got it somewhere on the Make It British website. So finally then, now I've busted those myths, should you be manufacturing in the UK? I know a lot of you that are here today already are, but in case you need reminding again, let me tell you about the benefits of making in the UK. So number one is that it is shorter lead times. That means you don't run out of stock. You don't run out of stock of your best sellers, and you can buy product in season and not wait a long time for it to turn up. So you can make things to order and you can supply on demand. Having your manufacturers closer to home means low to no transportation time and no risk of placing big orders that you can't sell. It creates jobs and helps local economy. It helps the local economy. That one is obviously a bit of a no-brainer. It's also easier communication. So if you've got your manufacturer on your doorstep, it's much easier to have meetings with them face-to-face and avoid miscommunication. So I think that's a really important one. And that's what I remember from my Tammy Girl days, for instance, more when I was at Burberry, when I worked in Italy. I was able to, as a designer and a product developer, I was able to go into the factory all the time to troubleshoot if there was any problems, but also to brief the manufacturer face to face. As you saw from the Christopher Nieper research, it also lowers carbon footprint if you're not flying stock halfway around the world. And let's not brush it under the carpet that those big retailers, they don't send everything on boats. They send a lot of stuff, if they need it urgently, by air. And Debenhams did a hell of a lot of that, again, because they needed their great big margins to be able to do that. But it's terrible for the environment. Also, as I showed, shoppers are becoming increasingly aware of greenwashing and where something is made. So consumer awareness is also one of the benefits you need to take into account. So I tend to call it as well, when businesses that don't make it here try to make out that they're incredibly British, and make people think that they're made in Britain when really they're not. But consumers are becoming much more savvy to that now as well. Made to order. So in a retail landscape where personalization is becoming one of the features that can set a product apart from the competition, made to order is much easier to do when you have your manufacturing in-house or on your doorstep. So you can personalize things, make things more bespoke, and that really helps you to stand out. And then finally, it preserves UK skills. So the Industrial Revolution started in the UK, and there are fantastic craftsmen here. We need to use them or we will lose them. So thank you. If you want to work with me as well to start or grow a British made brand or help you find the right manufacturer or promote your factory, I would love to help. That's how I get paid. In case anyone's asking, you've been doing all this with Make It British. What do you do now? I work with people to help them grow their brands, start their brands, find manufacturers. There's a short form on my website. If you want to fill that in to let me know what your goals are, what your plans are, there are several ways that we can work together. From anything from like booking me for a power hour to like solve a specific problem. I've got a manufacturer matchmaking service. And I've also got my British Brand Accelerator program to help you start or grow your British made brand. Thank you so much for coming, everyone.